Well, I've dressed up, and I got a compliment this morning. I went out, and Arlene said, "You look good in clothes." And my wife was standing there, and I didn't know how to react. I didn't know whether to grin, smile, or turn and look at her and blush. But I appreciate that, and it's an honor for me to be here. I thank Milton and the Mont Eagle Roundup for inviting me to come up here. And you know, I know I've known about this roundup for a lot of years. You know, a lot of years. I never had the opportunity because of various life situations, not made it up here. But you know, I'm grateful to be here with you today. You know, and I was taught early on to let people know that I do not represent Alcoholics Anonymous. But I will tell you that I represent what Alcoholics Anonymous has done for this drunk. And through the loving, caring fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous and you people, you know, I stand here and I have a life today that I could have never had. You know, AA gave me everything that I have. Through the program of AA, I have a loving God, that I have a trusting God that I can trust today, and I never had that before. I had one, but I didn't know how to trust it. I didn't have a relationship with other people. You know, I had hostages, and you know, I had a lot of that stuff. You know, but today I have loving friends and people that truly love me, and I love them. And you know, I go back to a little lady in my home group, Katie Reynolds. I walked in that group and I was 33 years old, and one of the first things that Katie ever said, she said, "Honey, let us love you till you can learn to love yourself." And see, folks, I was 33 years old and I didn't have a clue about loving myself. And you know, when she said that, I thought, well, she's probably popping a pill. You know how we are. We don't trust folks too good when we get here, you know. But I watched her, and she said that and she meant that. And you know, for the first time in my life, I felt like that there was somebody that loved me, truly loved me for no conditions, no, you know, I mean, and I believed that. And from that time until Katie died, and I think I saw her a few weeks or months before she passed. She was in a hospital. She had got sick and all that, and I went to see her. And she gave me that same little smile and that same feeling in my gut that I got the first time that I met her, and that was a lot of years span, you know. And that was the beginning of me thinking, you know, if somebody loves me, you know, maybe I am a lovable creature. And, you know, that's a blessing in my life, you know. Rand was up here and was talking about going to an Al-Anon, and he pulled the towel out. I started to bring a big towel and tell you, if I get too much into my own stuff, I might start crying, but but I won't do that. My sobriety date is January 17, 1988. Now, Carl spoke last night and talked about he and I went to meetings together in Florence, Alabama in 1981-82. That's true. But see, Carl must have got the right track at the first time. See, I got on that track, and then I decided I was going to work my program after about 6 years, and I got on that fast track where I let job and the making of money and all of that stuff become more important than my sobriety. And when you do that, you lose. Because I did not make my sobriety the most important thing. I made kids and a lot of things that are important, don't get me wrong. I mean, I have two children, and I had two stepchildren at the time, and I lost a home, and all of that was important. But I got too busy and too thinned out. And I can remember, we had a member in Bessemer Group named Allie Davis. And I can say his last name because these people are dead and gone now. But Allie's a black gentleman in Bessemer Group. And when I went there, there was one black gentleman at Bessemer. Two, Eddie P. I'm sorry, two, Eddie P. and Allie. And Allie called me and said, "Son, are you okay?" When I went back out and was out for about 6 months. And I told him a lie, like we alcoholics are real capable of doing. I told him I was doing just fine. And, you know, I'd been going to a meeting in Pelham. Well, there was a beer joint called The Frog in Pelham, and that's where I'd been going. It was a meeting. But, you know, I will always be grateful for those people, because Allie is one of those that I dearly learned to love in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and those people taught me how to grow up. There's a story in the big book, and see, I don't have to have notes because this story is my notes. If you read the story, and it's my life, and it's freedom from bondage. And in the fourth edition, it's not the last story in the big book. But in my books, it is, because I have second and third editions. But in the story, she said the mental twist that led up to my drinking began many years before I ever took a drink. Because my drinking was a symptom of deeper trouble. And, you know, when I got here, I thought, well, I got an alcohol problem. And shortly after I got here, it was explained to me that I might not have an alcohol problem. I had an alcohol solution. See, alcohol has never been my problem. Alcohol's the thing that I turned to. And just because I'm an alcoholic, that substance worked. Where other people can do it with impunity, I can't. First time I took a drink, I was 15-year-old. And that began a pattern that I had probably spent from the time I was born till then doing, and that's called stealing a line. And I stole two beers from my mother's case of beer. And I can remember, we were in Lake Schaefer and Lake Freeman around Lafayette, Indiana. And my mother and my stepfather had a cabin on the lake, and in the summers we would go up and spend the summer there, my mother and my brother and sister and I. And my stepfather would go into the city in Indianapolis and work, and then on the weekends, Friday, he would come out, and we had a cabin cruiser, and we would ski and ride the boat and play. And my mother would order beers, cases of beers, this big box, and the tops would open up like that. And there'd be 24 in there, strolls. And I'd see her drink those, and I wanted to know what it was about that, you know, I was inquisitive. And I can remember stealing two of those beers and going down in the boathouse and taking a string, tying around those beers, and put them down in that lake water. And that night I went down and took a church key, and if you know what a church key is, you're dating yourself. And I sat on that pier and popped the top on one of those, and I turned it up, and someone was talking about that first taste of that putrid, you know, but I wanted to know, so I went ahead and turned it up. Somewhere right along here, and I don't know where here was, but I got that feeling. When we were kids, we would go out in the summer and we would catch lightning bugs, put them in a jar, and that was a pastime. And you know how a lightning bug, you'll look and you see him, and then you don't see him, and then all of a sudden you see a glow. Well, that's what I got right here. I got that that glow. And it was a feeling that I had never felt. That all my life in the big book, it talks about being restless, irritable, and discontent. All my life, I was like that. I was like, you know, if you make Jell-O, I love Jell-O. You put Jell-O and mix it and put it in there, and you want it to congeal kind of. Well, and I'm impatient. So I want to get that Jell-O out and eat it, and I get it out, and it's going. And well, that's the way I felt all my life inside, those emotional, you know. And I truly believe that, as in the story, the medical profession would probably tell me that I was conditioned for alcoholism by the things that happened to me in my childhood. And I'm sure that they would be right as far as they go. But AA has taught me that I am the result of the way I reacted to what happened to me. But what's much more important than that is AA has taught me that through this simple program, I may experience a change in this reaction pattern that will indeed allow me to match calamity with serenity. And, you know, thank God that that's it. I had a childhood. My mother abandoned me at 6 months old, and she was an alcoholic. She took me, brought me to the hills of Tennessee. Her mother and dad lived in Jackson County. If y'all know, anybody knows where Jackson County, Tennessee is. It's around Gainesboro and Carthage. And I went to school at Difficult, and we lived about 2 miles from Defeated. And that's, I grew up with grandparents. I grew up with uncles being like brothers, and you know, I was one of them. I didn't know really where I belonged. But several years of my life, my mother, she married an Englishman in 1949 after the war, and he came over, and she would try to incorporate me in their life, and you know, it was just, it was one of those things where I wasn't accepted by a stepfather, and my home was with my grandparents, and back and forth, and back and forth. I can remember being 4 years old, and FedEx ain't got nothing on me. You know, now you can take a big package, you can go there, and it's a big package, you peel it off and put to and from, and you can put it in this thing and ship you off. I remember being 4 years old, and my grandmother put me on a Greyhound bus in Nashville, Tennessee, with a big label pinned on my shirt, and it was to and from. And if lost, if found, return to. And I would ride with a bus driver. She'd say, you see to it that he gets off at Indianapolis to this lady. And I remember Horse Cave, Kentucky, the bus drivers, they always stopped made at Horse Cave. I got to sit with the bus drivers and eat. And they would babysit me, and then I'd go stay however long I could stay with my mother until my stepfather and my mother would fight and fuss over me till my mother would return me once again to my grandparents. You know, and for years, that was an excuse for my drinking. For years, I could say, you know, because I was abandoned and rejected and you know, and I used that. And thank God this program has taught me it's not what happened to me, it's how I reacted to what happened to me. I had a loving grandmother that took care of me, and, you know, and I mean, I had a good life with them. It was all those feelings that I never knew how to deal with inside, you know, and that's just the way it was. But when I was 15, and then in this story, she talks about all of those feelings that you start feeling when you're young, and you know, the urges, and you know, at 15, a young man starts, you know, feeling those things that he don't know what to do with them, but he sure would like to try. And that was it. And I didn't have the ability to go to anybody and say, I'm feeling like this, and I'm feeling this, and you know, because I can remember being in Indianapolis one time, second grade. I remember School 82. They had numbers on schools there. School 82. And I sat in the classroom, and I stared out the window homesick for my grandmother, my grandfather, and all those people that they were my family. And I was with this strange person that's my mother, but she was a stranger to me. And I was living with a stepfather that, you know, he'd come in the room, and I'd go in another room scared to death that I'm going to do something or say something that he's going to jump on me. And, you know, I just lived in fear. And I had that homesick feeling in second grade, and I stared out that window. And, you know, I learned something at 7 years old that I practiced for many, many years, and it's a survival skill. When I feel emotions that I don't know how to deal with, I flip them off like a switch. You take that switch, there ain't no one by the door. But, you know, you walk in, you flip that switch on, and the lights come on. You flip it off, and they go off. Well, that's what I learned to do with my emotions, because I didn't know how to deal with them any other way than just flipping them off. I had a wife one time, so that means I've had several. And she told me, she said, we were in some conversation, and she said, what are you feeling? And I gave her about 5 minutes and stared at her, hoping she'd give me a clue where we could head with that. Because at times I just didn't know, because I'd shut it off, and then that was it. You know, and it's through Alcoholics Anonymous, it's told me to be able to look at myself and be able to deal with that and go back and deal with the childhood inside. You know, because my childhood was damaged. And, you know, I had to go back and say, okay, you know, and I talked to little Stevie. And, you know, and I told him, I said, I know you was not given the things, I knew all that, but look, it's time we grow up. It's time we get beyond that. And you're not going to make me pay the rest of my life for what wasn't done to you when you was a child. And see, it was the Bessemer Group of Alcoholics Anonymous and people in those rooms that taught me how to do that in a roundabout way. And I got in touch with my inner child, and I said, bull, we ain't going to go there no more. Because I played that scenario out throughout my life and made my adult self pay time and time again because of my childhood traumas that were so monumental in my mind. And actually, they weren't that bad. You know, it's amazing how we make, oh, it's so, you know, I was a victim. Well, you know, we're all victims of circumstances. You know, it's what we let those circumstances do to us. A circumstance, you draw a circle and put a dot in it, and that's a circumstance. The dot's me and what's going on around me, and it's how I react to what's going on around me. And thank God for you people. I was 17 years old, and I was living again with my mother. You know, my grandmother and my mother had this thing, is he loves me more than he loves you, so whoever had me at the time had possession. I was like, you know, I felt like a pawn. You know, chess. I played chess in the pawn, and that's the littlest sucker on the board. And everybody else just uses them to keep them protected. I felt like a pawn on a chess game. It's like, okay, he's mine, now he's mine. You know, I'll take him, no, I'll take him. And that's the way it was. I was 17-year-old, and I was living with my mother in Indianapolis, Indiana. And I was a self-will-run, riot young boy. I believe I was born with alcoholism. Now, if I had never drank alcohol, you couldn't call me an alcoholic, but you could probably call me a lot of other things. Neurotic, disturbed, psychotic, paranoia, you know, all of those would have been proper names to put with me. But at 17, my mother and I were not getting along because she said, come in at 11, and I'm, you know, I'm going to come in at 1. You know, just defiant. You know, that teenage years where, you know, you just have to go through that, and I did. And so one day I was working in a drugstore, and I saw a sign, and it was flapping in the breeze on some springs, and it said, be a man, join the Marines. Sounded like a novel idea to me. So I went home and proceeded to explain to my mother that, you know, that might be a good out for both of us, you know. And my mother, God love her, not knowing any different, she said, okay. She signed, and I got on a plane in Indianapolis, Indiana, and I went to San Diego Marine Corps Depot. And I thought, oh, man, I'm going to see the world. You know how your mind, alcoholic mind's a terrible thing, drinking or not. And here I am, I'm going to get off at this, and I'm going to, you know, they're going to give me this pretty uniform, and I'm going to be able to go out there and surf, and, you know, I can go see the ladies in my uniform. And, well, guess what? That ain't what happened. I got off, and there was a guy there who looked like Smokey the Bear hat, you know, that commercial about fire prevention. And he looked about like that bear. And he said, you know, for the next 8 weeks, you're going to be what we tell you to be, how to do it and all that. And I go, oh, wait a minute. Now, you know, I might have made a mistake. About 4 days into boot camp, after they shaved my head, I never had a sunburn on top of my head and blisters up here. And they give you these old fatigues and this big old yellow-looking sweatshirt that says USMC on it, and it nothing fits, you know, even the skivvies. I mean, they're hanging down to your knees, you know, and they're rubbing you raw, and I'm standing there, and, you know, you got to stand at attention. And I go, you know, this is not my idea of the wonderful military, you know, it's just, my, you know. So you can tell I lived in a fantasy world. So I went to my drill instructor, and I said, Sarge, look, there's been a problem. You know, I know you flew me out here. You give me bus fare. I'll go on home. Everything will be okay. Well, he proceeded to tell me what I was going to do and how I was going to do it, and if I didn't, he'd show me how to do it. And he used words that I shan't use from a podium because I don't believe profanity is necessary from this podium. You know, my home group taught me when I came here, I cleaned up my life, and the beginning of that's cleaned up my mouth. And he used words that I'd never heard. So I went back to my Quonset hut. We lived in a Quonset hut. It's a half-tin can cut in half. And, you know, and I developed something in Alcoholics Anonymous I learned called a resentment. You know, I didn't know what it was at the time, but I knew I needed something. And I resented that guy. You know, after all, he's an old man, he's 22. And he talked to me that way, and I was going to show him. And you know that perseverance and that stamina and that drive that we have, it works for us for a long time. Alcoholics survive on, God knows, the stuff that we use to survive. But, you know, I survived till I got here. And so I was going to follow him around, and I was going to step in the middle of his back when he fell. I slept with my bayonet in the Quonset hut, hoping he'd come in there because I was going to stick it through him. He never did, because I think he had a clue that we didn't like him a whole lot. But you know, out of that experience, and this began a pattern of my life for many years, out of that experience of my resentment and my anger and my determination, I succeeded. I was promoted PFC out of boot camp. And from that time till a lot of years later, my drive was based on I had to kick it in high gear somehow by being resentful, angry, bitter, and I'm going to show them. And that's what I did. And as far as alcohol goes, when you are a Marine in dress blue uniforms with PSC stripe on your shoulder, you can go anywhere and they'll serve you booze. They don't question how old you are or nothing. And that was my experience. I was the best Marine by day. I was a two-year Marine because back in the 60s, they had this thing in Southeast Asia called the Vietnam War, and they needed a lot of bodies to be shot at. And so the Marines changed their program and had what they call a RA program for draftees in the Army because people was going to Canada. And they said, if y'all come in, you come in the Marines, we'll give you the same enlistment as the Army does. And I said, okay. So that's what I did. I'm a two-year Marine. By day, I was the best Marine. And that pride and all that and doing a good job became something because I'd never had that instilled in me like that. And I did it. And I was the best Marine by day, but night I was the best drunk Marine you'd ever seen, you know. And I served honorably in the United States Marine Corps and was discharged. And I went overseas and came back. And when I got out of the service, you know, I was around 19, not quite 20. And here we are. What do? You know, you're drinking. I got a job. I was the same pattern. It's just something that you learn. By day, I was the best work. I did the best work in whatever job I had. And at night, I was the best drunk by night. And that's in my 20s. That was a pattern of my life until I walked in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous because that progression of that disease began. Because I started adding life situations on that. I met a young girl, and she liked me, I like her. We were sitting on the hood of my car at a rock quarry drinking beer. You know, it was one of them great relationships. And out of that union, I have two wonderful children. Now, was it love? No, it wasn't love because I didn't know what love was. It's amazing. I'll have to share this. My children are grown in their 30s, and my first wife is 56. She's in a hospital in Nashville with congestive heart failure. And we have two lovely children, and we have six wonderful grandchildren between us. And because of this program and you people, I love that woman today. I don't like to cry. Well, I got on my knees and I asked God to watch over her and protect her. And see, this is a woman that when we divorced, and she left me not directly because of my alcoholism, she left me because she was trying to find her own self too. You know, I was bitter and just angry at her, and I hated what she did me. She left me, you know, again, and there's abandonment issues. And today, you know, thank God that I can, you know, have the feelings in my heart for her because she's a wonderful person. We were just young kids, screwing up, not knowing how to do things right, trying to do the best we can, and through the years, you know, we've learned to grow up. And today we have love for each other, and my wife's here, and my wife and her, I mean, we just have a wonderful relationship. We'll go to Nashville for a grandkid's birthday or something, and I'll be sitting there, and Lisa will be there, and Debbie's there. Debbie's my first wife, and Debbie says, Jacob's over yonder, he needs his nose wiped. Steve, go wipe his nose, and then Lisa will say, Steve, go get me that, and I'm going, God, I got two of them telling me what to do. But it's wonderful that you can have that. And see, I owe that to Alcoholics Anonymous and you people. That's not anything I've done. When she and I divorced in 1979, my drinking had progressed to the point that I drank every day, But I went to work every day. And that's one thing about it. Someone's talking about a functional alcoholic. I went to work every day. Never missed a day of work, you know. But when I got off, I drank. I drank for however long I could, for as long as the money was lasted or whatever, or they throw me out of a bar or something, and I go home. 1979, she left. And the big book talks about that point of for an alcoholic where they cross over that line from a hard drinker, trouble drinker, to an alcoholic. And I believe in February 1979 that happened to me. Because when she left and took those children, my world ended. And I go, well, you know, I ain't got no reason, you know. I ain't got no reason to live, you know, other than just drink. So I worked and I drank. I drank a fifth whiskey every day. I get off work, stop on Dixon Road at Last Chance Liquor Store. That's a hell of a name. And I'd get a fifth of Old Charter. And I'd go in and I'd drink, you know, enough of that. And then I'd spruce up and I'd go out and I'd do the things we drunks do. You know, I'd go to the places and doing the things that we do. And then I'd come dragging in 3, 4, 5 o'clock and I'd finish off that fifth. And I'd lay down, pass out, or, you know, a lot of times I'd say I went to sleep. And people said, well, you passed out. You didn't go to sleep. And that's what I did. 1979, I came to Birmingham, Alabama, and for South Central Bell. I was working for the phone company then. I went to work phone company. Been working for them for about 10, 11 years at the time. Because when I got out of service, my MOS was pole climber, so I went to work for them, and I'd progressed up, and they'd promoted me to a manager. And I came to Birmingham. And I found another reason to live, and she was 5'9", a blonde, I thought, you know. And I was like the drowning man going, you know, how drunks are we, just kind of floating in the water going dippity-doo, and your hand goes up and dippity-doo, and then somebody comes along and pulls you up. And that's what she did, and God love her. She had two children by a previous marriage, and we got together and moved out in Shelby County, and everything was going great. And somebody was talking about drinking beer and shooting pool. Well, I never shot one game of pool and never drank just one beer. And I can remember September the 9th, 1980, I got off work, went to a little bar on 14th Street down there from the work center, and we shooting pool and drinking beer. At about 9:30, 10 o'clock, somewhere around there, I decided I might ought to go home because my wife, well, she might be in a better mood if I got home before midnight. And I headed home in front of Ollie's Barbecue there on 8th Avenue, where it used to be. It's not there anymore. I met a Birmingham policeman. I was on his side of the street. He didn't like it. So he proceeded to escort me to Southside Jail. And I sat on that sheet metal bunk. It was 2x4s in sheet metal. And I sat there, and I think I was 33. And I said the first prayer that I ever said that I was sincere about. Now, I said a lot of prayers before. You know, God, give me all this, and I'll never do it again. Oh, Lord, help me, you know. But that prayer was, God, if this is what's intended for my life, so be it. But if not, show me another way. And let me tell you, he's shown me a way that's been more marvelous than anything that I've ever could ever imagine. Next day, I called. I looked in the phone book, and there's two phone numbers in there. One's Birmingham and one's Bessemer. And I lived on Cherokee Beach, and it's closer to Bessemer. So I called. Jim Reynolds answered the phone, and I inquired about the meetings. He said, yeah, we're having a meeting tonight. Come on down. I walked in the rooms of Bessemer Group Alcoholics Anonymous, and I found a bunch of people like y'all that were smiling and laughing and cutting up and carrying on, Charlie Birch and all these people. And, you know, I can go on and on and on with the names of these people because those people I've grown up with, those people have taught me how to live and how to get rid of all of this past, you know. They talk about the God. My grandmother taught me a God of fire and damnation and hell and brimstone, and he's going to get you. Well, by 12, I was got, because 11, I did it. And that fearful God. And see, those people taught me I could have a God of my understanding to me, personal to me, not to you, to me. And see, today is, you know, I have a loving, trusting God that I can trust, that loves me no matter what. It's not based on what I do. It's not based on what I say. It's based on he loves me in spite of all of that. He loves me when I'm in my darkest, dirtiest cup. And he loves me when I'm in the sunshine too. And see, that's what works for me, because I needed that. I needed that cleansing. I needed that purification to know that I'm good enough for God. And you people gave me that. That I'm good enough for God. See, I always felt like I wasn't good enough for God. I was a tainted, tarnished from birth, you know. But you people taught me that's not the case. And see, that's one of those things Alcoholics Anonymous gave me, because I have a God that I can trust today, this personal to me that I can go to anytime, no matter what goes on, I can go to Him. And I started getting active in the group. I started making meetings. We used to go to jails. We used to load up my car, and good God, we'd go to, you know, and that's back. And Carl was talking about, we'd head out, we'd go to Jasper, just anywhere, Tuscaloosa. And, you know, I loved it. I found a family. See, I've always needed a family. I've always needed that feeling, because I never felt like I had it. You know, with my grandparents or with my mother, and they are, and God love them, but I never felt that. The Bessemer Group of Alcoholics Anonymous has been the family that I've never had. And that's why I love it so much. We were real active and going, and my wife came to Al-Anon a couple of times, but I don't know, you know. She didn't think she had a problem and needed. She said those women in there had more problems than she did. And I'm going, okay. And she, you know, I didn't force it on her, but I kept going to AA, and she resented AA. Because, see, you people began to do something for me that she couldn't do, and she got mad. I mean, she didn't like that. She didn't like me looking at my life and looking at all of this, and maybe, you know, maybe I'd see some things that I might have to change. And she didn't like that. And that rocked along, and then we lost our home through a tornado, they said it was a windstorm, but it was, the trees were twisted. So, but anyway, we lost our home, and then me being raised by a grandfather who was a carpenter, I decided to build a home on my own. So I built a 3,500 square foot house by myself, you know. And I was a district manager for the phone company at the time, had 66 men working for me, had four children, two in Alabama and two in Tennessee. So needless to say, you can understand, my life was kind of stretched thin. And that's when I decided, well, I just can't go to a meeting tonight. I can't go, and I started slacking off and quit going to meetings. And I got into that pressure, and I had back surgery in the middle of this, and I'd borrowed $40,000 from Shelby Bank on a 90-day note to build this house. And I had to pay it back, and I was laying in the hospital, and Dr. Fevinger was working on my back, and he said, I said, Doc, I got to walk and get out of here. And he said, why? And I said, well, I told him, I said, I got a $40,000 note due in 90 days, and I ain't got the house finished yet to refinance it. He said, well, you got a reason to walk, ain't you? And I got out of there, and I walked, and I finished that house and refinanced it, and everything was great and wonderful. Had a big, fine, beautiful home. But, you know, in the process of that, my wife and I and the strain and all that, I went to Georgia. My kids were living in Macon, Georgia at the time, and my ex was living there with number two wife, a husband that she had had then. And I went to see my children on the weekend, and I came in, and my wife was real strange, and all of a sudden she called me up to the kitchen. She said, I want out, and I want you to get out, and blah, blah, blah. So here we go again. So that was in 1988. I came back into the program in 1987 and started trying to get sober again, and I went to Atlanta, and I called my wife, and I knew it was over. I knew she was leaving. So here again, my world just falling down. So I went down to the bar, and I asked the bartender to give me a Coke, and I was, you know, kind of distraught, and you know how we are. And I turned once again to the thing that I always turn to that fixes the pain and the hurt, and I said, give me a bourbon and Coke. And the next thing I know, I was winding up someplace called Cheetah 3. Chet, you know where that's at, don't you? And, you know, thank God there was a friendly bouncer in there that guided me to a room and back to my room and all that, and I got safe back to the room, and, you know, I slid off that bed, and I said, God, help me. I don't know what to do. Next morning, I walked into the Biscayne group of Alcoholics Anonymous and Maggie Harris, and she's dead and gone now. Thank God for that woman. Thank God I walked in there, and she could see because she was a tough old bird. I mean, a lot of guys go in there, and they'd kind of go like this around Maggie. And I went in there, and she had the most loving, I mean, it's just, I was a lucky dude that day because she showed me the compassion and the love that I needed. And she said, you know, Steve, you don't know how to do this again if you don't want to. And I said, okay. And that was the journey nearly 20 years ago of my recovery. And because of those people, like Maggie and like Jim and Mickey and Fran and Bob and all of these people, and some of them are here tonight, this morning, I began a journey of trying to recover, and I'm still in recovery. You know, I woke up this morning with not a back pocket full of spirituality. I got to do something today to get it. You know, I have untreated alcoholism every day. I've got to do something. Or that disease is just waiting for the chance to grab me by the throat and take me back out there. And I truly believe that because my experience is I knew how earnest the first 5 years I had good AA, I had good sobriety, I was earnest, I was trying. But you know what? When you let up, when you slack up, when you start making those priorities of everything else in this world more important than your sobriety, guess what? There's nothing left to do when you get in those dark spots that someone talked about that you don't see any way out. And the only way out is, you know, I need to make this pain go away. And alcohol always made that pain go away. Of course, the pain that it created was, you know, exponentially compared to what, you know, but that's what it did for me. You know, and thank God for those people. And I got in the last time, and you know, I remember moving to an apartment in Bessemer, and Garland helped me move, and I moved in that little one-room apartment out of that big mansion. Because, folks, that was a mansion. Because I was raised in Jackson County, Tennessee, where we had a house and board and battens. You could see the chickens running around through the cracks, you know. And we had water, and it was about 100 feet behind the house or on a little spring around under a tree. And then when we went potted, it was about 75 feet in the opposite direction. So this house I had built was a mansion, you know. And for years, the making of that stuff, because, see, I needed to make myself something. I needed to be something. You know, I needed to be something. And the only way I knew to do it was do that. I was like a chameleon. And y'all know what a chameleon is? That's a lizard. Now, that lizard turns green when it gets on a green limb, turns white when it gets on this white stucco siding. And that lizard does that so he can blend in with its surroundings. But you know why that lizard does that? Because he's scared shitless somebody's going to eat his ass. That's why. And that was me. I was scared to death you're going to see the real me. I was scared to death you see the truth about me. You know, that dirty, nasty me that I didn't want anybody to ever see. And thank God for the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. It allowed me to be able to free myself. Carl talked about, you know, those steps. You know, step one, you know, I mean, I took step one when I walked in those doors. If I hadn't, I didn't need to walk in these doors. If you think you got a problem with step one, you need to go on back out there and wait till you say, I ain't got no problem with step one, until you truly admit you're powerless over alcohol and your life's unmanageable, go on out there, because sooner or later, if you are, it's gonna say, duh. And then the two, you know, came to believe. I had to come to Alcoholics Anonymous to believe that there was a power, and that power was the one that I had. I just had a misconception about it that was taught to me by somebody else. And then the third one was, you know, making a decision. It's kind of like the frogs. You got three frogs on a log, and one decides to jump in the water. How many you got left? You got three, because he just decided. He didn't do nothing. And that was it. See, a decision. You know, every day I wake up, I make a decision. That third step is a decision. I turn my will in my life. This morning I got up, I said, God, help me be the best me I can be for you today. You know, if I do that, that's as far as I can go with it. You know, now I might have to stop 3 or 4 times a day and say, well, let's back up and let's try this again. Because of the error of my way, I do. But, and then the fourth step, you know, is just looking at, just like Carl said, looking at the people I resented and why it had affected me. Because, you know, it was all about what it did to me, that selfishness and that self-centered and that self-pity and wallowing in all of that stuff and using it any way we can to get where we're going, because those were the skills that I had honed. And then five is meant to, ooh, that was tough. But, you know, I got somebody to do that with. There was a priest who used to come to our group. And I thought, you know, he might be a good one to do this with. Maybe he won't squeal on me. Father Hillary's gone now. But I did that. And, you know, and there's principles, and Jim Hawkins taught me about. He had them written down on a piece of paper one time, and he showed me those principles. And he said, five. He said, you know what the principle behind five is? And I said, no. He said, integrity. He said, you know what integrity is? See, all my life I thought integrity is what you thought of me. If you could just love me and like me, and, you know, if I could impress you, then I feel okay. And he said, integrity is not what folks think of you. Integrity is what you think of you. And see, I've learned that I love me today. You know, I'm the best 60-year-old, nearly bald-headed, chubby fella in the world. And see, for many years of my life, I loathed myself. You know, now on the outside, I'd pretend, oh yeah, I could put on this face and make myself look like, but inside, I didn't feel that way. And because of step five and the people in this program, I do. And six and seven, you know, those are the shortest ones in the books, but those are the hardest ones, because six is looking at those stuff, looking at those defects, looking at that stuff that is I've practiced and lived with for nearly 60 years. And seven is the ability to be humble enough to say, you know, I can't rid myself with this without help. You know, humility comes from the word humus, and you know what humus is? Dirt. So I have to get down to earth. I have to get real. And people in my group help me get real, get just down to what I am. Not any more, not any less. Because I'm an egomaniac with an inferiority complex. And that's the extreme ends of the spectrum. You know, somewhere in the middle, I got to find a balance where I ain't leaning and tilting too far each way. Because on any given day, whatever's going on in my little world, I might lean the wrong way. But because of this program and you people, I can find a little bit of balance when I can go to God and humble myself. And then, you know, eight and nine is eight, just a list. I did it in four, like Carl said. And if I didn't, you know, then I need to go back and add some too if I forget. And amends. You know, all my life I thought amends will say, well, I do something. I said, I'm sorry I did that. And then next time I need to do that, I do it. You know, but amends means to change by addition, subtraction, or modification. That's what amends means, to change. See, and I had to change. One time I was in Portland, Tennessee. I was living there and working up in Tennessee, and I got drunk at the VFW. And I had an old 52 Ford pickup truck, and I was going home, and you know how your eyes are kind of crooked, and the roads are gravelly, and the back end is real light on those old trucks, and it's scooted around. And I tore a guy's fence, about three spans of his barbed wire fence up. Well, I came back the next day, and I told him, I said, well, I'm sorry I did that. And I said, I'm going to fix it. So I got a roll of barbed wire and some post, and I mended his fence. And then I made amends to him. You know how I did that? I took another way home. But I changed my route. And that's what it's done for me through the steps. I've learned to amends is that, to change. And then, you know, you go on to the 10, 11, 12, and those are the maintenance steps that we just continue to do, you know, continue to take personal and promptly, like somebody said, promptly means now. If you owe money, pay it. If you lie, you go to somebody that has harmed others, you tell them now. Don't wait till next year and go, well, maybe they forgot about this, you know. And then 11 is the spiritual awareness. That's the principle behind it. See, I realize I'm a spiritual being in human form, you know, and that we're all children of God. And through the loving hands and hearts of Alcoholics Anonymous, they've loved me, and they've allowed me to grow up and mature. And, you know, and the guys I sponsor now, I'm so grateful for them. I mean, they are a blessing in my life, because working with them and me seeing myself, I mean, they're me. You know, they're me. And then I can see them grow and get their life back a little bit. And I have one that I started sponsoring him in 1987. And he'd go out and drink and go out and drink and go out and drink, and, you know, like we do. And finally, 3 years ago, he'd come in and he was pretty whipped. And he said, "Steve, I need you to sponsor me." And I said, "You gonna listen to Everett?" I said, "You waver one iota from what I tell you, and we're through. I ain't gonna put up with you no more." Okay, you know. And in July 5th, he'll have 3 years. And because of that growth I've seen in him, he's grown. He's being a productive member of society. He's getting his brother, his mother, his all of that life back. He had a son 24 years ago through a relationship with a young woman in South Carolina, and he got in touch with that boy, and he went to South Carolina and saw that boy, and this last week that boy flew to Birmingham and went to Talladega Race with his dad and his uncle, and he met his grandmother, and you know, and through that, see, that family, that feeling, and when I hear that, it just, my heart glows, because that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for us. That's what it does. And the success rate is 100% if you do it. Now, you can take in the percentages down the road and say, okay, how well am I doing this? I mean, these people say, well, it won't work for me. No, it won't work for you if you don't work it. And work, my sponsor, and I'm standing up here in her stead. She was supposed to speak, and her health was such that she can't. She's got 34 years of recovery, and she lives in White House, Tennessee. And she's my aunt. She's the lady that came in 1973, and she gave the book to my mother, who came in this program in 1977. My mother's got 30 years. And then my mother sent that book to me. And now here I am. And then when Jim passed, he was my sponsor till he passed. And then I got somebody, and she's just like him. She tells it like it is. Don't beat no bones around about it. I'll call her about Lisa. I'll say, you know what she's doing? And I just can't understand. And she'll say, okay, what's your problem? What's your part in all this? And I go, and about end of about 10 minutes of that, I'll go, hey, honey, can I swap over and speak to my sweet aunt? But thank God for those people in my life. See, I need that. I need a sponsor. I don't care how long you're in this program. You need a sponsor or a friend or somebody that can tell you the truth about you. Because if you don't, then you're going to con, and that unconstitutional and capable of being honest is going to come back. And then I'm going to lie to me, and then if I lie to me, I guarantee I'm going to lie to you. But thank God for this program, because the people in my group, alcoholics that recover, their recovery has to be grounded in depth and weight. And you know what depth and weight is? The truth. And thank God for the truth. You know, on our tokens, you know, you say, the truth will set you free. The truth has set me free about me. And today, because of God's grace and the loving grace of God, and grace is an unearned gift. I didn't earn the right to be standing here sober and happy and fulfilled in my life. I didn't earn that. But then faith. Faith is not free. Faith has, you have to earn that. You have to work for it. And the faith is what you people taught me when I'm asked to do something. And the butterflies ain't left yet. And I get up here and I do this because I love Alcoholics Anonymous enough that any way I can repay Alcoholics Anonymous, I will, because I can never repay it, you know. Because it's given me everything that I ever wanted, and bottom line is that's what I always wanted anyway. Thank y'all.